Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. It's Ryan Ballingy. It's April the 18th, 2023. Hope you're doing well when we're recording this. It's a Tuesday show. Haven't done a show for a little while. Week, 2 weeks, something like that. A lot of reasons for that. I want to talk about that a little bit in today's show. Also wanted to talk about Rory McIlroy choosing to skip the RBC Heritage and what Jon Rahm kind of seemingly did it in response that might have won himself a whole lot of fans. And we'll talk a little bit about the Chevron Championship. Maybe what may be the net effect of moving the LPGA's first major to a little bit later in April and moving venues. We'll see a little bit about that. And I do want to touch a little bit on slow play as well. We'll talk about that maybe as part of the discussion around the RBC Heritage. Patrick Cantlay, just something needs to be done. And we'll talk about that a little bit as well. But a little bit of an explanation for why I haven't done a show, I guess, in 2 weeks. And one, it was Masters Week, and Masters Week is always crazy. I mean, it just is on my side of things. I'm sure it is for everybody in golf media. You just all of a sudden sink yourself into it, and then it's Thursday afternoon, and the tournament is underway. And the week of the Masters is always pretty crazy because you got to get a lot of things done. You got to prepare for the tournament. You've got to, you know, with the work that I do on the golf betting side of things, prepare models and picks and give explanations and do radio interviews and things like that. And I love doing those things. But then each and every day leading into the tournament, all of a sudden, I find myself at like 3 o'clock going, I didn't even breathe yet. And that's kind of what happened here. I mean, fortunately, we had an incredible week, Masters weekend, actually last week for the RBC Heritage in terms of listenership. Never been better. We had about 30,000 people for Masters week. I won't have all the numbers for the RBC Heritage until a couple days from now, but it'll be a little bit less than that, but still a really, really good number for the number of people tuning into a golf radio station that didn't exist 6 months ago, which is pretty wild to me. So that's been cool. But the reason we didn't do a show last week, I was down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina for the Masters tournament itself and my kids' spring break. And we stay with my sister-in-law. She lives down there. We have a great time. And Monday, I wasn't really planning on doing the show. The Monday after the Masters is always just kind of a, you just gotta breathe. You finally can. And we just took the day off. And I was like, okay, I'll just record this on Tuesday. And it'll be fine. And on Monday night, our dog, Dottie, who we had for 12 and a half years, when we came home, we were out of this place in Myrtle Beach called Broadway the Beach, which is a little off the beach area. It's kind of like its own little shopping, entertainment district thing. And we went there because the kids wanted to go. And we came back. And usually when we come home, whether it's my sister-in-law's house, our house, my parents-in-law's house, my parents' house, wherever, Dottie would greet us. Come to the door, kind of yelp a little bit, wag her tail, be very happy, wanted to be pet, wanted to say hi. And she didn't do that. And I found her in the kitchen, my sister-in-law's kitchen, laying down, leaning against the wall, and looking at me very scared. I mean, she looked like she was telling me, this is bad. And I didn't understand what was happening at the moment. We knew from the recent vet visit that things were probably coming close to the end for her. She had a growth in her like stomach or somewhere in that region in her abdomen that was eventually going to kill her. And she had been arthritic in her back legs for a while, and she had fought it for a long time, getting around really quite well to do what she needed to do. And for about 4 years, she's dealt with at different stages of it. Cancerous growth on her right front shoulder. And we had it removed, and it came back a couple of years later, which we knew was a possibility. But it had grown to the point that not that it had overtaken her ability to move around, hardly, but eventually it could spread and affect the rest of her. But so I picked her up to see if maybe she just slipped and felt nervous. I mean, floors can be slippery. Picked her up, and she had a hard time walking. And overnight, things just didn't get better. It got substantially worse, actually. And unfortunately, we had to euthanize her on Tuesday morning. And it was devastating. I mean, my wife and I, we adopted Dottie because of golf, because I was able to work from home when I started working for NBC Sports full time in 2010, in that fall. And we had, just got married, and in that May, and I wanted to get a dog. And Katie's, my wife's, request was, if you can work from home, you can get a dog. And when I landed the job with NBC Sports, I was working from home. I was working from my at the time condo, and that was why we got the dog. That's why we got Dottie. She was Tyra. She was 3 months old, and we went to the where we lived at the time's animal shelter, and played with her and really liked her. We renamed her Dottie because we didn't like Tyra as a name, and she was ours. I mean, she was our first kid, first love in that regard. And she went through so many changes in life with us. The birth of our two kids. She's great for them, great to them. She's just the best. And that was one of the most difficult moments. I mean, I obviously haven't, I've led a pretty great life. And to be that sad in that moment, I knew that was going to happen, right? I mean, how can you not anticipate that? But just the wave of different things that you feel going through the process, and the animal hospital that we went to that we'd never been to in Myrtle Beach, they handled things very, very well. They're called On Point, and I really appreciated that because they knew. I mean, they know what it's like. They do this probably several times a day, if not several times a week, and they made us as comfortable as you could be. They gave Dottie Hershey's Kisses treats, which you're supposed to give dogs chocolate, but in small doses. Well, Dottie found a bag of chocolate not too long ago, a couple months ago. She ate some chocolate for herself, and her stomach didn't seem to care. But it was a really difficult day, a couple days, and driving home was difficult because I would look back in the rear view mirror of our van, and we always had Dottie in the back laying on her one of the third row of seats on her bed. And she wasn't there. And she wasn't there, like nervously smiling until she got settled. She wasn't there to take out to go to the bathroom and walk a little bit when we made stops. And coming home the last few days has been tricky from taking the kids to school because Dottie's not there to say hi and welcome me. It's a very strange feeling. And my wife alluded to this last night. And if you've lost a dog or a pet, you've probably gone through this. So maybe I'm just speaking to the choir here. But as we kind of like the house is more silent, like the house is more quiet. I don't coming down here. I record in my office in the basement of my home. And even coming down here to record this was weird because otherwise, when Dottie was alive, I would have to consider where she was and made sure she was settled down and okay and had food and water in case she needed it while I was doing this. And realizing the possibility, especially when she was younger, not so much at the end, but that she could try to come down the steps. And actually, about a month and a half ago, I was doing this show and recording it, and she tried to come down the steps, and she had a hard time with steps at the end. Basically lived on the main floor of our home, and I could not believe she was trying to come down here. And now I come down here and it's quiet and I don't have to think about that. And I wish I had to think about that, if that's strange enough. I wish there was that little bit of stress, because that would mean she's here. And that makes me kind of sad. That makes me really sad, actually. But I wouldn't have had Dottie in my life were it not for the opportunity to do this job, to be able to work from home these last almost 13 years. And that for that, I am eternally grateful. I'm so grateful to have had a companion like her who would sit at my feet when I would work in the living room all these years, and just someone to pet and think about and be happy with and take a break with and go on a walk with and Now I can say the word walk and not freak out that she's going to think we're going for one, which also is pretty sad. And we've kind of heard almost phantom noises of sometimes you almost hear in your brain Dottie pawing against the stain or the sliding glass door to come back in or to go outside, stuff like that. It's really weird. But I wanted to talk about her in part because there's a connection to golf, right? As I said, she never would have been in our lives were it not for the ability to do this job, or at least it wouldn't have been her, it would have been a different dog, I guess. And I know the response when I tweeted out about Dottie being euthanized, the response was so I mean, great and incredible and very, I'm very appreciative for anyone who responded, either Twitter or my personal Facebook, stuff like that, Instagram. But it felt more human than golf. I mean, I know we're connected through a love of golf and an interest in golf, but Dottie was family. Dottie is family. And when you lose someone in your family, yeah, that's a whole lot different, obviously, than golf or not being able to play or being able to play somewhere cool or having some kind of bond over that. I think everyone has experienced, especially at our stage. I'll be 40 in 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks. At this stage of our lives, we've all experienced loss, a significant loss of some fashion. And this was a different one, a non-human one, but still incredibly painful. And it's going to be weird for a while. But hopefully, too, once we as a family get through our summer travel and get through the Ryder Cup, we're going to do the Ryder Cup and Solheim Cup together back to back, my wife and I. Once we get back from that, then maybe we can have another dog and start that journey all over again. And that I'm willing and looking forward to that, I think says a whole lot about what dogs and pets can give to us and do give to us, and they do it wonderfully, and that you're willing to put yourself through the pain at the end and the hurt, the monumental amount of it, for everything that they give you in their lifetime. And hopefully the love that we gave to her was matched by hers for us. That's all I can hope for. All right, let's talk about slow play. That's a bit of a transition from one sad topic to the next, I suppose. But let's talk about slow play. Talked about this a little bit the last time I did the two off the first, which again was about a week ago. But I haven't talked about it on this show in a fair amount of time. Over the years, I've talked about slow play, and it's never gotten better, right? And there are always bad actors who moves slow regardless. Therefore, the modern day Patrick Cantlay was J.B. Holmes, who was indignant about his right to play slow for the amount of money he was playing for. And there are plenty of other players who are not quick. Jordan Spieth can be quite slow. And there are guys who are a bit more glacial than him. And he has times when he can be a little bit quicker. I think he gets a pass from a lot of people because he spends a lot of that time talking to Mike Greller and giving us some kind of Freudian insight into how he thinks about golf. Cantlay just seems to kind of sit there, and he talks about it, obviously, a little bit. Not to the same extent, not with the same amount of charisma, certainly not as entertaining about it. And Patrick Cantlay is just, it's unwatchable when he plays golf. And you could see it on the faces of everybody involved with the final threesome on Sunday at the RBC Heritage, where, oh, you had it's just it was bad. It was really bad. You had Billy Foster at I mean Billy Foster betrayed his he's not a good poker player. He's Matt Fitzpatrick's caddy. Billy Foster betrayed his emotions so many times. I mean, at one point, I want to say on 14 or 15, he just put his elbow on the bag and head in hand, looking like this is unbelievable how slow this guy is and how long he takes, and it's unbearable. And people were keeping track on timers, apparently, and they weren't happy with Cantlay. And Cantlay's tried to respond because he had a hole in one earlier in the week, and he tweeted something pretty funny. I'm playing faster. Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it's a good joke about a hole in one, well played. But I just there needs to be a better system in place to enforce the timing rules. that the PGA Tour has than what they have now, which is effectively a joke. It's nothing. They don't enforce them. They might fine you if you get, what's it, like 20 bad times. Like it's a lot. You have to do a lot just to get fined a little bit of money. And the little bit of money that you do get fined, especially if you're a successful player, is totally worth it compared to what you're earning. If you get fined $25,000 for slow play when you're making $5 to $10 million a season, who cares? Take the penalty, cost of doing business. Take the financial penalty because they're not penalizing you in strokes. And we've talked about this before over the years where obviously strokes are more meaningful, are more painful to the player than a basic financial fine, whatever that is, especially if you're a better player, because the stroke can mean the difference between winning and losing, right? The stroke could be the difference, especially in a designated event where $3.6 million goes to the winner and $2.2 million basically to second place. That's a $1.4 million difference potentially. Now, of course, that's not guaranteed to happen, but that's the most it could hurt if you have a timing penalty. I guess you could have an even bigger penalty, financially speaking, if you did in the Tour Championship, right? It would be even bigger. The $18 million is obviously a tremendous amount. But it doesn't necessarily even have to be that big of a deal. The difference between in a designated event like 25th and 30th could be a stroke because of how many ties there are. Well, that's a lot of money. That's more than the $25,000 for a bad time or lots of bad times. And those could pile up. And I think the PGA Tour has to start considering this. And I don't think they necessarily have to implement a timing system like the one they had in that one DP World Tour event, European Tour event, they called the Shot Clock Masters, where they had in Austria, one of the long-running tournaments, usually the like Diamond Open or whatever it is, Diamond Resort, where they had it. But they had maybe it was in the Czech Republic, I don't remember. But they had this tournament, and they had a cart with every group, and they had a display of how much time they had to hit. And I like that idea, but I don't think we need to start with that. I think the public and peers of these slow players need to be made aware of what is going on and how it is affecting the product for them. And I think it starts with having a count-up clock. Going and having on the standard for the standard bearer, the people that walk around with the scores, have a little LED display, and you time each player. And once it gets above what would normally be the accepted time, and it changes whether you're first to play and where you're playing from. But once it gets above that, turn the green light to red and let fans see they are taking too long. See how often they take too long. And then add it all up and say, here are the offenders. Make it public. Here are the players who take the longest to play on average. Here are the players who take the longest to play on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday versus Sunday. Some people slow down when all the money is on the line. The people who play the slowest in weekend rounds versus weekday rounds, when they're in contention, when they're out of contention, all of those types of things. Could track it all and then say, here's the baseline. Now, based on all of that, here's what the timing rules are going to be. And they could be exactly what they already are or not. But then take those LED displays that you have on the standard bearers, and instead of counting up, you count down. And it's up to either the standard bearer or someone with a remote control who controls it, but that's your shot clock. And you force these players to play at a proper pace, because there are issues in golf with par five accessibility, trying to reach par fives in two, right? We talked about this a little bit with the Masters, with the par fives being accessible, but not so far down that, I don't know, the distance to the second shot's a little bit more, so that sometimes create a little bit of extra waiting because the rollout isn't quite as much. So it just creates an awkward backup really for everybody. And I don't necessarily think distance has everything to do with it, the added distance, but it happens on par fives across the PGA Tour because there aren't really three-shot par fives anymore. I mean, there may be a couple, but not many. And even if they were or are likely three shot par fives, the analytics tell us that it's better to go for it and get as close as you possibly can before hitting a third shot, which means waiting until that space clears. And that does create timing issues, but that's not it. That's not the only thing that's going on here. And players who take forever to talk through a shot or to prepare to hit a shot or whatever that is, they need to be sped up. That will make the product better. The three ball final group at the Heritage played in a smooth 5-10, which stinks. I mean, relatively speaking, the PGA Tour is not terrible, but it stinks because that's 5 hours and 10 minutes of interminable golf. If you play in twosomes, 4.5 is more reasonable. So part of the slowdown was that you're playing three, not two, and you've bunched them all together. It makes it harder to space it out and go quickly. But it's too much. It's too much time. A three ball can be done by the best players in the world in under 5 hours. It can be done at 4:45. I believe that you can play a two ball in 4:15. And if the way you set it up is not necessarily to regulate how quickly you walk from shot to shot, which, hey, you can slow things down that way, and some players do. But if for the 65 to 75 shots player hits on average, if they do it in 30 seconds or 40 seconds instead of a minute, and you could create timeout allowances, you could say, as a player, you have, I don't know, two shots around. I'm just making this up. But let's say you have two shots around where you can suspend the shot clock, and or you can get a time extension to 3 minutes. I don't know, something like that. Where on a one that's really important, you say, hey, and they have this in like bowling. They have a re-rack, which is effectively the timeout, where you go, I have like a re-rack, please, get a little extra time, and then you got to roll. Well, we could do that in golf and say, hey, I want to take a timeout, again, or add time or whatever. You get an extra 2 minutes to hit your shot. Just want to take my time on this. Totally cool with that. Maybe, I don't know what number of those there are per round, per tournament, but whatever. But make those available and track those. And if you do not keep up with the time, then you add a stroke. The end. Or if you really wanted to be especially weak about this, the second one, you get a stroke. You can mess up one time. But I think everyone has seen that follows sports pretty closely, multiple sports closely, especially baseball. Everyone has seen the benefit of the rules changes, the timing changes, bigger base, shift stuff. The finding rules that make the experience better for the fan is a good thing. And having the timing rules on pitch clock is brilliant. It's driven down the time of games by like a half hour on average, even for high scoring games, which is tremendous. If we can do that in golf, and obviously it's a little bit different, right? There's lots of pitches thrown in a baseball game, something like 400 pitches. Well, if you slow down, if you take all of those, take all the time out, right? Let's call it 300 to 350 pitches. I don't know the exact number of that, so please don't hold me to that. But if you're throwing at least that many, and pitches that used to take 45 seconds to a minute are much, lower by 20 to 30 seconds on average. Well, all of a sudden, you've saved a whole heck of a lot of time, right? But not everybody works fast, not everybody, stuff like that. All those asterisks and caveats. If you did that in golf, you have fewer shots, right, per group, because you're just not, there's not pitches to shots, is not analogous. But if you have 70 players reach the weekend and they all hit shots, and let's just say on average they shoot 70, well, that's 4,900 shots. If they're all played quicker, that's all going to work out better. Every group is going to be faster, right? So between a group, a twosome, 140 shots, if they play of each, I don't know, 20 seconds faster, 15 seconds faster. Let's just say 20 seconds for the sake of argument, because it's a little bit easier to do the math in my head. But if you have 140 shots and on average you play 20 seconds faster, then you've got 2,800-ish seconds. Well, that's a lot of minutes. Because 60 seconds in a minute, right? That's about 45 minutes worth of time you're saving. That's a lot. That's good for the product. That's maybe fewer commercial breaks. That's more shots you can show. Because especially with the Sunday lineup, CBS and NBC do very similar things, even though they're very different telecasts these days. But they both do the same things of harping on the same players down the stretch on Sunday because they're the ones who can win. And then you kind of drop back or go forward and show the players who can't win, finishing up, waving to the crowd, all that nice stuff. But on Sunday, you're showing these guys. If they play quicker, it means you can show more of them. And you don't have to do the whole, you know, eye on the course thing. Just show a commercial and come back. They'll be ready to play. And you can time it better. It can be more reliable. You can show more shots. All of that works out better to the fan. And yes, there are going to be some guys who don't like it. I don't care. I really don't. I think fast play is an important, being able to make a decision quickly is an important part of golf without undue delay. How much time you want to assign to that, the players can negotiate for themselves. But I think that slow play needs to just kind of be dealt with just by like every other sport has. Every other sport has dealt with it. Shot clocks in pretty much every major sport, even lacrosse. Lacrosse used to have an interminable problem with slow play and just holding on to the ball and didn't make it exciting. Well, guess what? Shot clocks have made it exciting. They've got serve clocks in tennis. Everything is better. Golf needs to do it. We need to get on board with it. I'm not saying that golf used to be faster. I'm pretty sure it used to be faster than this. I realize there's a lot of money on the line, but there's a lot of money on the line in every sport. Every sport has a timing system, and they have a penalty for it if you don't comply. We need to get one. Let's get one going today. All right, I want to talk a little bit about Rory McIlroy and Jon Rahm. They're just had two very different weeks after the Masters, and, well, frankly, the week of the Masters, right? McIlroy missed the cut, the Masters, Rahm won it. They both committed to play the RBC Heritage because it's a designated tournament. Rahm played it out. Rory withdrew. Second time McIlroy withdrew or did not play in a designated tournament. He skipped the Tournament of Champions, and so this is the second designated event he skipped. Under the PGA Tour's rules that everything all these guys agreed to abide by for this season, you could only skip one before you could potentially lose at least some, if not all, of any money you could get for the Player Impact Program. So the idea is that, hey, he could lose like $3 million because of this, McIlroy. But also, there's the asterisk that Jay Monahan has already said, I get to decide who gets paid and how much they get paid and whether we take any money from them, and that we're not going to penalize Tiger Woods, for example, so that he doesn't get paid from the pit money because he only can play a couple times a year. He's going to get his money. So if you set that precedent already, you could already see where this is going to probably wind up going, and McIlroy would get his money or darn close to it, you know, a little bit of a penalty. Now, asterisk to all of this, or the caveat to all of this, is we don't know exactly why McIlroy withdrew, and since we don't have an injury list in golf, a true one, we don't know if he's hurt or if his pride's wounded or he just needed a break or what. He hasn't said that. So once he says that, we'll have a better sense of that. So I don't want to jump on the bandwagon of just criticizing McIlroy and saying that he's selfish and a bad guy and a jerk. I don't want to say that because I don't know the real reason why he withdrew. And if you make an assumption, then, you know, a couple weeks later, I'm going to come on this show and go, well, McIlroy, turns out his arm fell out of the socket or something, you know, something like that. And I'm going to look heartless. So I can't do that. I can't say that. I don't think that's fair to say. But obviously, the appearance of McIlroy not playing is bad. It's not good. It can only be bad. It can't be helped. So the question, I think, is, does he have a legitimate excuse? And when is that going to come up? And will he make up for it in some fashion? Will he go play an event that he wasn't anticipating playing this year to make good for it, or what? Well, I guess we'll see about all of that, right? But Jon Rahm, I feel like, filled a void last week created by McIlroy's absence. Even though, obviously, Rahm being the new Masters champion is very much a draw. He's very much now a two-time major champion, very much someone people want to see. And I thought it was very interesting because he was pretty direct about this, I think, about not withdrawing, sticking with his commitment this week. And then he was kind of led on a little bit, I think it was Friday, by a reporter who was asking, well, why did you even try this week, basically? Why didn't you just take a miscut and get out of here? And Rom gave the same answer, or the same variation of the answer, a couple of different ways in those different sets of questions. Pretty much just said, look, I agreed to play this tournament. I'm going to hold up my end of the bargain. And people paid good money to come to this thing. I think if they paid money to come see the best players in the world, well, I'm one of them, and I'm the reigning Masters champion. I should be here, and I should try for them, and I should give them my full effort because they spent their money and time coming to see me play or other people play. And I think that won over a lot of people. Some of the responses I've seen on my Twitter timeline about this, and I tweeted about this on Sunday, because what really struck me was the ovation Rom got at the 72nd hole from the fans, who were great. They're always great at Harbortown. But it felt like they were really amped up for this, because this is the first time they've had a designated event. They had 40-ish, 41 of the world top 50, because Will Zalatoris had to withdraw and Rory withdrew. But they were very happy to have the kind of field that they had. And they might not have it again, or may not have it anytime soon, depending on what happens with the designated tournaments. And they were really, I think, appreciative of Rom choosing to finish it out, giving a full effort. I'm sure he was out of gas at the end, but they gave him a lot of love. And I don't think it was just isolated to Harbortown Golf Links and the people in attendance. I have a feeling he won a lot of people over in the last week because he finished this thing out. He saw it through as the Masters champion. This often happens in golf where you win a big tournament, you win a major, and you just withdraw from the next one if you were going to play in it, because your life is different and it takes a lot out of you to win a big any tournament, but especially a major championship. But he didn't do that. And he not only kind of bathed in all of that adulation, but then even went a step further and hopped into commentary on CBS, sitting alongside Amanda Renner and Colton Ost, which they've done a good job bringing those two together as a pairing to kind of work these designated events together. And Rom was so insightful, really just well-spoken, and it's easy to forget that he came to this country to Arizona State really not speaking English. He learned it because of American rap music. He is quite eloquent. He's really got a good sense of wit around him. He's just a good guy. I've had a couple of different interview interactions with him over the years. And I think people got to see two sides of him that maybe they didn't know. One, that he really cares about the fans and how that's perceived and what he believes a major champion and a number one player in the world should do. And I think he's simpatico in that regard with Rory as well, but with Scottie Scheffler and his other peers, that like, hey, people pay their good hard-earned money to watch us play golf. And for some people, that's a huge expense. I'm going to honor that by giving my best effort. And then for him to do very well in commentary and to show another side of giving insight about golf and just having a good time doing it and talking about how interesting it was to be on the microphone side of things, the playing side of things, the analysis side versus the competition part. I thought that was great too. And it was really interesting to see that juxtaposition of here's John Rahm, the reigning Masters champion, new world number one, sticking it out, finishing things off, earned a pretty decent payday. I mean, all things considered, of course. And I then goes the extra mile to kind of ingratiate himself to the fans, not only in person, but also at home. And the number of responses that I saw, and this is anecdotal, of course, but from people that said, you know, I've kind of warmed up to Rom, or maybe I didn't like him at first or was kind of blah about him, but now I like him because he did this and he was willing to do that. And I think that's what golf fans want, right? They want accessibility, yes. And there's kind of been this trope that, well, as soon as an athlete says what they really feel, they get slammed for it. Well, yeah, there's some danger in that. If you say something unpopular or you have an unpopular belief, then that's the risk that you take. But Rom didn't have to take a risk here. All he had to be was appreciative of what he has. And he demonstrated that very clearly. I mean, there's a whole golf industrial complex at a professional level for people like him. That there are sponsors who pay millions of dollars. There are fans who combine pay millions of dollars. There are TV networks who pay millions of dollars. There are media people who make a living off of this. That there are a lot of people who, in some fashion, indirectly or directly, rely on professional golf. And I think all of those people involved just want to feel like they're appreciated and matter. And that's the most basic of human things. It's just to feel appreciated and that you matter, not that you're not being kept taken for granted or taken advantage of. And Jon Rahm did and demonstrated the things you had to do to make it clear to people that he appreciates them and that they are valuable and meaningful and that he wouldn't be where he is without them and all of that good stuff. That's all it's got to be. You don't have to, you guys want me to just say controversial stuff. And I'm sure there are reporters who want that. But that's not what fans want, I don't think. I think what people want is just someone who's genuine and genuinely appreciative of the opportunity that they have, no matter how far they get. And Rom demonstrated that. And I think, again, won a whole lot of people over for doing that. And hopefully for Rory McIlroy, it's not a, you need to do this way. I mean, he's very charming. He's got a great personality. He's easy to get along with, I think. There's a reason a lot of media members like him because he speaks from the heart a lot, is an emotional guy, and tells you what he's thinking. Those are good things. The thing that happened this week, though, I think is the result, the problem is that people now think, well, he can just blow this stuff off, the stuff that he built. And that last part, the part that he helped build, is really important because he's not going to get as much credit for that, I don't think, as he or maybe some of us in the media might believe. Not in the bigger scheme of things. You know, maybe 20 years from now, they go, hey, Rory McIlroy was really important in the restructuring of the PGA Tour. But for guys like Scheffler and Rahm, they're like, yeah, I kind of stay out of the administration stuff. I just want to play golf. Thanks, Rory, for doing all this work. Being on the board is not a thankless job, but it's not a thankful job either, where you get backpatted all the time. And so while that is important, and while I'm sure his peers appreciate that, I don't think fans do. And I think at the end of the day, he needs to, no, he doesn't need to. I'm not going to tell the man what he has to do. But I think he got impacted this week by being perceived as someone who could just blow off fans after he made a commitment. And honoring your commitments, I think, is one of the most basic things we can do to honor other people. But also one of the easiest things you can do, even when you're not healthy, even when you're playing bad, to show up, put a smile on your face, sign some autographs. I know it's a lot this year, but it feels like for what they put together, just to honor those commitments is the right thing to do. So kudos to Rom for doing it. I'm not going to just poo-poo McIlroy for not doing it, but he finds himself in a bit of an awkward situation because of it. And hopefully he can find a way to remedy that moving forward, and we'll go from there. First major of the LPGA year is this week, the Chevron Championship. It's moved to the Woodlands, Texas, which is just outside of Houston. And the club at Carlton Woods is the club. It's a Jack Nicklaus design. It's the new home for this tournament. Chevron moved this tournament down to this area. They moved the date because they didn't want to compete with the Augusta National Women's Am, which has been played opposite what had been the ANA Inspiration since it started, and Augusta National wasn't moving that because they have found Augusta Weeks instead of Masters Week. basically 2 weeks worth of golf celebrating Augusta National and 2 weeks of Augusta National celebrating golf with the Women's Am, Drive, Chip, and Putt, and the Masters. It makes sense. Augusta wasn't going to budge. So they did the right thing, right? Decided we need to make a change. So we got a new sponsor here. We're going to move venues. We're going to move dates. And I'm not sure how that's going to work out, to be honest with you. I think the way that it was somewhat beneficial for the LPGA, even with the distraction, noted distraction of the Augusta National Women's Am. And I say that because it felt like it was part of the run-up to the Masters. And people, and I can show you the data if you're ever interested in this from a data perspective, but you can see the interest level in the Masters really start to take shape like Saturday afternoon before tournament week. And then Sunday picks up huge, and then Monday goes crazy, right? Like it's just, hey, it's Masters week, let's go! Wah! And people get really interested in it. Well, the ANA Inspiration kind of benefited from that because it was on in prime time. It was on later because it was on the West Coast. And for where the percentage of golf fans are like, yeah, but I want to watch some more golf still. I'm still not satiated. They watched this tournament, and it has had its own history, had its own traditions, Jumpin' Poppy's Pond, the robe stuff. The Mission Hills had its own, obviously, landmarks. The 18th was a big deal. So people kind of got to know it over the years. And now you've gone to a new place and a new date. And I don't think people know about it, frankly. I don't think they're aware of it. There's not as much awareness of it. And I think that's going to cause a problem. Now, the good news is there's way more network coverage of the event this week because that's what they got by moving. They had the opportunity to get covered on network TV because CBS is going to air the Zurich Classic this weekend. NBC is going to air the Chevron, which I think is great. That's awesome. I'm very happy about that. But I hope that there needs to kind of be more of an apparatus to talk about the LPGA and to make people aware of the product. And I was talking about this yesterday. My son's Cub Scout troop, we were talking, a bunch of the parents, we're talking about different sports and why some do better than others. And I said that the primary thing that I have about the LPGA isn't, I think a lot of people are over this idea. I mean, there are select people on Twitter who think as a 2 handicap, they could smoke the LPGA and in its entirety and win the money list. Those people are isolated and assholes. But if you strip away those people, I think by and large, the idea that you wouldn't watch a sport because a woman is playing it versus a man, I think that's largely gone away. I think that's been largely extinguished. I never had that problem. I think some people still probably do, but I think that has gone down tremendously because of a variety of women's sports that have drawn people in. There are 10 million people watched the NCAA women's title game between Iowa and LSU. More than double last year. Incredible numbers. Women's sports are having a bit of a moment. The NWSL does great. The U.S. Women's National Soccer Team does incredible numbers on TV. We've seen audiences come in for women's sports in a way that's never happened previously. And I think people are getting over this notion of, well, because a woman is doing it, it's not as good as a man. We're not as entertaining or whatever it is. I think people are largely over that. So the issue with the LPGA to me isn't that anymore societal, you know, a societal matter. It's regularity. Think of all of the sports that do really well on TV. Football. You know exactly when college football is. Saturday. All of it. You know when the NFL is. Sunday. All of it. But also Monday and Thursday. Sometimes Saturday too. But you know Sunday. And you also know the other times. Baseball. You play from April to October. Pretty much every day, there's always a game. And if you miss it, there'll be one tomorrow probably. So it's kind of hard to miss that schedule. There's always something going on. Hockey and the NBA, very similar. They struggle at times because it's not as always clear when they play. And they play different days of the week. But if you're a national fan, there's always something on. There's always something on in those sports. Golf on the PGA Tour level is very predictable. if you are a golf fan, and I assume that you are because you're listening to this, you know when the PGA Tour is going to be on the weekend. 1 to 6. Every single weekend. Might be sooner. Might be 12 to 6. Might be 12 to 7. But you know from the hours of 1 to 6 p.m. Eastern, golf's going to be on your TV. First half, first couple hours on Golf Channel, rest of it on one of two networks, NBC or CBS. And if you've been watching this long enough, you know which network covers what. Basically, the ones NBC covers are the ones you got to know. Everything else is CBS. You know that. Thursday, Friday is very clear. You know when golf's going to be on. Probably from 3 to 6, 3 to 7, 2 to 6, 2 to 7, something like that. Maybe a little bit longer. Sometimes in prime time, if it's a West Coast event. But generally speaking, during the meat of the golf season, somewhere between 2 and 7, Golf Channel's got golf. PGA Tour Golf Thursday, Friday. You want to watch it, go there. You know where it is. Or you can watch it streaming, of course. They're known quantities. The LPGA doesn't have that benefit. And they've never had that benefit. They don't have regular times that they air because the PGA Tour commands that in their contract. And in my view, it would behoove the LPGA to come up with an agreement with NBC Sports, modify it, where they say, look, we'll air on USA Network. If you can give us a regular time, we will air on that network. We'll give you live sports during a time of day when you're airing, you know, some rerun of another show or another movie or whatever. We'll give you live stuff to watch. And if you can give it to us at the same time, almost every week in that 2 to 6, 3 to 6, whatever window, we'll take it. We'll be on a different channel. I think it would work. Because you would then know, hey, this is where and when the LPGA is going to be. Last week, obviously difficult because they're in Hawaii. So a little bit difficult to deal with. But when you're in the continental United States, you should be able to figure that out as the LPGA. And the sport, I believe, would pick up a lot more momentum if it was just that, if you could just simply have a standard known time when the LPGA would be on. I think it would go a long way. I hope this is going to be a great week. A lot of interesting golf played last year, of course. Lydia Ko played great, resurgent. She played great to start the year, is married and happy. Jin Young Ko's back, already won after a year with a bad wrist, especially the back half. Nelly Korda is playing pretty well, needs to kind of follow up that first major with a second. Atiya Thitikal is a great player, has an opportunity to become a number one type player for the long haul. Got some young guns. Get some players or compelling storylines. Be kind of cool if Lexi Thompson finally got another major. Stuff like that. So, lots to look forward to this week. But I think the biggest thing for the LPGA is just having a standard place to come watch it every single week that they're on. Be great. That's going to do it for us this week on the 19th Hole Golf Show. Thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your support. Thanks for listening to me talk about Dottie and non-golf matters. Hopefully the golf content was good too. And you enjoyed it. If you listen to us through a podcast platform, please give us a 5-star review. Helps us reach more people. Leave a comment. Email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Always happy to talk to you about golf, life, whatever you want. And then if you want to follow me on social media, I'm at Ryan Balaji. We'll be back with the show next week. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.